This interview was produced for Red Eye, a 3-hour current affairs program on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
The number of people who have died as a result of the bombings in London is now known to be 50 and is expected to climb further. 700 people injured in the blast from 4 separate bombs on the London Underground and on a double-decker bus. A group has claimed responsibilities, but authorities have not verified the claim. The attack came in the middle of the G8 summit in Scotland, where Western leaders and demonstrators were presenting opposing perspectives on globalization. And this morning we're joined by David Miller at the University of Strathclyde, which is 35 miles from the G8 site at Glen Eagles. David is the author of Tell Me Lies, Propaganda and Media Distortion in the Attack on Iraq, and more recently, Arguments Against G8. He's in London, where it's early morning. Hello, David. Good to talk to you again.
Hi. It's actually late afternoon here.
Is it late afternoon? Did I say early evening, late afternoon?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
What's been the range of reactions in Britain to the bombings in London?
You've got the official reaction, which is to condemn the attacks and to start to use them to pursue the interests of great power, to pursue the interests of the Blair government of the transnational corporations. So you have they've been spinning that the reason that they didn't get any breakthrough at the G8 summit was because Tony Blair was distracted by the bombings as a means of defraying some of the frustration which has been built up around the G8 summit and the lack of progress that they've made there. So that's the official reaction there, and they will use this to pursue their agenda as fast as they can. Whether that will be successful or not is another question. Another reaction that one gets is that we've already had reports of mosques with their windows broken. Two mosques, I hear, just this afternoon set on fire, which is a really appalling response to the attack. And then, of course, we have the response of the movement, the global justice movement, the anti-war movement. I've just come this last 10 minutes from a peace vigil at the Quaker Garden of Remembrance up the road, just across the road from King's Cross Station, where one of the explosions happened. 2,000 people there wearing black armbands and standing for 2 minutes silence in remembrance of the victims from London on Thursday, and also in remembrance of the victims of the war in Afghanistan and the attack on Iraq 2 years ago. So it's very clear that the response of the movement here is to say that we condemn terrorism and we condemn war, and that we think that they're two sides of the same coin, that terrorism comes from the policy of war pursued by the Blair government in this country. But I said a minute ago that whether it would be successful or not is another question. I think that's the most important question. What happens as a result of this?
Mm. Now, David, you've been quoted as saying that this is a time we should be thinking, for instance, of the citizens of Fallujah in Iraq. What connection should we be making here?
Well, clearly, the civilians who died in Iraq, in Fallujah, in Tikrit, in the other places where there are all-out assaults on civilian buildings and civilian accommodation, are victims of terrorism just as much as the victims in London are victims of terrorism. It's quite clear that the actions of the US and the UK in Iraq have made the UK a much less safe place. We've never had this kind of attack before, and it was Tony Blair's own intelligence agencies which told him 2 weeks before the attack on Iraq was launched that an invasion of Iraq would heighten the security risks in London, and so it has come to pass, and it's appalling, all the more appalling for that it was foreseen by the intelligence agencies, and the government took no steps to avoid it. So that's the context of it, I guess. But the key thing here is that we live in a world of increasing inequality, of increasing misery for millions and millions of people, and some people, as a result of that, take unacceptable measures, i.e. terrorism, whether they be the poor of the world or the rich of the world, who respond to threats to their interests by violence against civilians.
The timing of the incident, which coincided with the G8, is, of course, very striking.
Yes, and it was clearly, I hesitate to say, to peer into the mind of the people who did this, but and in most cases I would deprecate such peering and speculation, but it's clear that this was an attack planned to coincide with the G8 summit. And the G8 summit, of course, is the summit of the world's 8 most powerful countries, not the world's biggest economies, because, of course, Japan and Italy are in there, whereas economies which are huge and in the top 10, like China and India, are not. But it's the 8 most powerful countries in the world who meet together to rule, decide how the world will be ruled. And you're immediately struck, when you put it like that, that the world is made up of, what, 170, 180 countries, and it's 8 countries who meet every year to decide how things will be run. So the question of democracy hangs pregnantly over the whole G8 summit, and the question of whether the G8 leaders will respond to democratic wishes is a question which hangs there, and which they will not deal with as an issue. They have their outreach groups. They invite Thabo Mbeki, the favoured neoliberal child from South Africa, or they invite Kofi Annan from the UN, but there's no sense in which the G8 is a democratic body. It's not elected by anybody, so there's a real problem there of democratic legitimacy. But that's on top of the real problems with the actual agenda of the G8. They're supposed to be dealing with Africa and with climate change, and we've seen the conclusions of the summit if you were a comedian, you couldn't make up something as bad as what they've come up with on climate change. The final communique is less effective than the US government's position. On Africa, they've managed to come up with $25 billion extra in aid, which of course comes with strings attached, requiring privatization and liberalization of African markets. So the outcome of the summit is a real disgrace, and should spur everyone in the movement on to protest further against the problems which are caused by the G8.
Well, I think you've made the point that there's a tremendous gap between the rhetoric of the G8 and what's actually really happened there on the ground.
Yes, I mean this is the key to it. I mean, I think if you look at the Bush administration, the Bush administration is fairly clear about its agenda. Bush said just the other day before the G8 summit that he wasn't coming to the G8 to make things better. He was coming to pursue U.S. interests. And I think while we might be opposed to Bush, that's at least fairly clear, and there's some clarity about what they're aiming at. The Blair administration, by contrast, makes all sorts of grand statements about Africa being a scar on the conscience of the world, says Blair. Brown, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, shortly to take over as Prime Minister, has been saying that the arc of the moral universe must tilt towards justice, in one of his flowery phrases. And they make the claim that they are actually trying to sort out the problems in Africa and trying to sort out the problems of climate change. But of course, that's the rhetoric, and underneath the rhetoric is the reality. And the reality is that they are actually leading the neoliberal drive into Africa by insisting that African countries privatise their economies, they open up education, health, water to the market, and they open up access to resources in African countries for the Western government. So the key to this is the distinction between rhetoric and reality, and the reality is very, very much worse than the rhetoric would allow you to think.
Now, the in response to the bombings in London, I've heard the responses of G8 leaders described as moralistic posturing. Blair, for instance, uses language like, "They will never succeed in destroying what we hold dear." What do you make of that kind of response?
Well, it is rather pathetic, isn't it? But the question is, what is it that we hold dear? I mean, they intend it to be read as democracy, freedom, and prosperity. But what they mean is their power. What they hold dear is their power. They don't care for democracy or for change.
Increased security isn't able to prevent these kinds of attacks, yet politicians are quick to support tighter security and to reduce democratic rights. It's a theme that we've seen played repeatedly in North America since 9/11, and it's even the purported rationale for the war on terrorism and the illegal war on Iraq is to increase Western security. Do you think that the British public will be manipulated to give license to the security and control agenda following following this attack?
Well, this is the most interesting thing. I think that this is pretty unlikely. I mean, what happened after 9/11 was that there was a lot of leeway given to the US government and actually the UK government to push through curtailment of civil liberties, the interests of the corporations. But now, after Iraq, after the lies about Iraq were discovered and are now known by millions, it's going to be much less likely that they can do this. It's also clear that the movement after 9/11, the global justice movement, did pull in its claws for a wee while, thought it couldn't criticise US imperialism anymore, and advocated, you know, less criticism of Bush. That clearly isn't going to happen this time round, and so they're going to find it much more difficult to push through their interests, although, of course, they will try.
Mm. Following 9/11, there was a swift and massive increase in racism and systemic targeting towards people of Arabic and Muslim origins here in North America and obviously elsewhere. Where do these communities stand in the face of the attacks now? We've heard of these the attacks against some mosques in Britain.
Well, that is the worry, and there will certainly be some of that. But of course, one of the first things that the people here have been saying, I'm just standing in the middle of a conference in London, which is dealing with these issues. There have just been huge meetings about the relationship of Muslims in Britain with the left, and it's clear that the movement here sees the interests of Muslims and the interests of the left as being in some way similar, and there is a strong sense in which we must stand together with the Muslim community. And the Muslim community increasingly sees, I think, that the left can be worked with, especially over Iraq and over war, and now over this kind of issue. So it's not at all clear that this will put the movement back. It's clear that there's a good sense in the UK that people must work together.
David, from here it seems very poignant that London, the city in which a million people came out to protest the war in Iraq in February of 2003, has now been brutally attacked. In the light of these attacks, what do you think people engaged in the anti-war and global justice movement, how do you think we need to respond?
Well, it's clear that we need to respond by refusing further attacks on Muslims and further assaults on civil liberties. But I think that we've got a wider agenda than that. I mean, we've just seen in Gleneagles the biggest demonstration in Edinburgh, the biggest demonstration last Saturday ever in Scottish history. We held the biggest political meetings in Edinburgh last Sunday, 5,000 people coming to all sorts of meetings, 60-odd meetings in Edinburgh. And then we managed a peaceful demonstration to the gates of Gleneagles, despite the provocation and the intimidation of the police forces and of the government. So the people in Scotland and all the people who came to Scotland for the Gleneagles meeting are in good heart and seeing that the movement must go forward. We must build a movement which involves political parties and other organisations, but it must go forward on a much wider agenda than simply the question of terrorism and civil liberties. And I think that's a very positive thing.
Thanks so much for joining me this morning, David. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
Okay.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with David Miller of the University of Strathclyde in Scotland. David's the author of Tell Me Lies, Propaganda and Media Distortion in the Attack on Iraq. And more recently, he's written the book Arguments Against the G8, and he spoke to us this morning from London, England.
Red Eye is produced by an independent media collective and airs on Vancouver Cooperative Radio. You can hear the program from 9 until noon Pacific Time, streaming live at cooperadio.org.